Welcome to the View My Seats podcast. My guest, John Thorne, is Major League Baseball's official historian and curator of the Our Game blog on the Major League Baseball blog network. John, as a historian, someone who appreciates the past, what are some of your earliest memories as a baseball fan?
Well, as a fan, of course, every fan remembers his first ball game. And my dad took me to the Polo Grounds when I was 10. And I saw my beloved Dodgers beat the hated New York Giants 5-0. Johnny Podras threw the shutout. Dick Snyder hit a home run. I was in heaven.
On the Our Game Major League Baseball blog, you recently put together a baseball integration timeline. What were some of the most interesting and important things that you learned while completing this work?
I learned nothing in particular while completing the work, although I will say that I invited readers to add items that I might have overlooked, and there were indeed 7 or 8 good contributions. The thing I learned recently that is reflected in this timeline is that despite what scholars have been saying and writing for 100 years, there is documentation of African-American slaves in the South playing baseball prior to emancipation. And this was a bit of news to me, not to Larry Hogan, the great expert who tipped me to this. The Library of Congress had images of some 1938-39 WPA transcripts, that typewritten transcripts, that had not been digitized for OCR, so they were not searchable. So this is lurking in plain sight all these years.
And does the lack of racial diversity today in regards to how few African Americans are playing Major League Baseball concern you at all? And if so, what would you do to help make the sport more diverse?
I think Major League Baseball is doing an outstanding job of diversity. Although African American representation is in decline, the signal point to reflect upon is that the color bar that existed prior to 1947 was not instituted against African Americans, but against people of color, no matter what their national origin or birthplace. And today, your percentage of major league players who are men of color is near 40%, an all-time high. African-American participation is down around 7% from a high of perhaps 19% circa 1969-70.
Do you think the issue, therefore, is more of a socioeconomic issue rather than an issue of race?
I think it's a cultural issue, and there is an upside to how one views this. No one complains that there are perhaps fewer Jewish furriers than there were in 1910. The industry has changed. There are more opportunities for African Americans to climb the socioeconomic ladders of America in fields other than baseball. So African American participation in the American dream, economically, continues to march forward. Though there's still a long way to go, there are distinct advances, particularly for someone who's been alive as long as I have, and can recall what life was like in America in, say, 1961.
This year, Major League Baseball will attempt to speed up the game. Do you think that the new rules are going to make much of a difference? And if you were Commissioner of Baseball for a day, what kind of changes would you like to see to increase the overall efficiency of a baseball game?
Well, that's a difficult premise if I were Commissioner of Baseball for a day. I don't wish to run this circus. This is not my strength. I reflect on the past and advise on the future. But changes to the game are to be undertaken with due consideration and great respect. And it's because Major League Baseball and baseball altogether is such a delicately balanced mechanism that the slightest adjustment can have unforeseen and calamitous results. I will recall when batting averages were dropping in the 1960s, this was because Commissioner Ford Frick in 1963 altered the strike zone so as to make it a pitcher's fiesta. He was afraid that with Maris having beaten Ruth's record, that all the batting records would tumble. In fact, instead what happened, all the pitching records tumbled. And the adjustment of the mound, height from 15 inches to 10 inches between 1968 and 69, produced an immediate boost of 10% in run scoring in both leagues. So one has to be careful. And in any event, the issue here is not speed of game, but pace of game.
Do you think that the pace of game does need to change, or are you happy with how long it takes to complete a game today?
Again, your question conflates pace and speed. Two hours of a good thing, to me, seems not as good as 3 hours of a good thing. So I'm not worried about the time of the game. What I am concerned about is batters stepping out of the box and kissing their jewelry and looking to the sky and counting the fans in the stands. I am concerned about pitchers. Daisuke Matsuzaka being an example, famously, taking 35, 37 seconds between pitches. Now, the consequence of delay and attitudinizing by individual players, excuse me, the attitudinizing was a point of concern as long ago as the 1870s. Pitchers were charged with hastening their deliveries and not playing to the crowd as if they were the Adonis of the box.
But do you think that pace of play is perhaps one of the reasons why the game of baseball doesn't resonate with young people in this country today like it once did?
Again, I challenge the premise of your question. We're not going to return to baseball being the only sport that anybody cared about, as was the case in 1910. The other sports that people cared about then were horse racing and boxing and college football. Pro football hadn't yet emerged. Hockey was not a factor in North America on a spectator basis. And, of course, basketball in the 1910s was a white sport dominated by Jews. Sports change. I think baseball has more than held its own. It's very hard to look at absolute numbers and not think the game is more popular than ever. If you look at percentages, however, there are more opportunities available. There are more entertainment vehicles sift through. I think, you know, baseball is not only a $9 billion business with $100 million plus in attended professional games, major and minor combined. Baseball is our family album. It's what connects us as a people. It's the game your dad took you to and he'll take your kid to. And it's the long season. Unlike other sports, 162 games plus postseason, it enables us to mark time. Mark our lives in this country and on this planet.
And John, as someone who has presided over much of the current sabermetric revolution, why hasn't the in-game box score, evolved to incorporate advanced statistical analysis?
I think you're seeing more and more of first-tier sabermetrics entering the mainstream. I'm always struck when I go to a ball game and I see on the electronic scoreboard, the Jumbotron or whatever it happens to be called, Diamond Vision, you see the OPS or the on-base percentage. I mean, these were in taboo terms, unknown. The first appearance of on-base average as an official statistic was the year after Hidden Game of Baseball appeared. It goes back to 1985. I think baseball is a conservative game. It's a game slow to change, which frustrates some, but is part of its essential strength.
Do you, by any chance, play fantasy baseball?
I do not. My allegiance is the traditional one of a fan to a city, not a fan to an aggregation of players and the gambling element in fantasy and the ability to attract players. While I understand the attraction of it, my sons, all three of them, do play fantasy baseball. I do not.
And I think you would agree, even if you do not play, that fantasy baseball has certainly been good for the exposure of the game as far as reaching people who the sport might not be reaching otherwise.
Your view is one that I have come around to. It was not one I subscribed to originally. It seemed at the outset that the fraying of one's loyalty to a civic aspect of baseball, you know, that you were a Milwaukee fan, that you were a New York fan, that you were a Houston fan, was a bad thing. Because sports grew out of civic attachment. And the whole notion of a champion, for example, who stops to reflect that the original meaning of a champion was one who stood instead of his community and competed against selected athletes of other communities for the honor of that town. A champion is a surrogate, not merely a victor.
In your book, Baseball in the Garden of Eden, you alluded to how gambling helped legitimize the sport early on in its history. Can you explain why that was? And as a quick follow-up, do you foresee a time soon when Pete Rose will be allowed back in baseball and perhaps the Hall of Fame?
I'll answer your second question first. The Pete Rose matter is completely in the hands of the commissioner. He is on the ineligible list, which triggers, by Hall of Fame ruling, his absence from the ballot. So if he were to be restored, this would be fine with me, but not fine with lots of others. And there's a delicate balance here to be struck. This is the cardinal sin. And despite the fact that gambling was great for baseball until it wasn't, by which I mean in the 1850s and 60s, you had your first game-fixing scandal in 1865, but prior to that, gambling served the role of bringing the attention of adults to what had been, for 200 years nearly, a bat and ball game for children.
And so that's what you were intending to mean when you talked about how baseball was legitimized by gambling, because it increased interest.
Absolutely. There was a combination of gambling and promotion in the newspapers and the publication of scores and statistics. The rapid accretion of statistics to the game of baseball legitimized it to adult readers who were accustomed to reading the maritime schedules and the stock tables and the commodity tables.
John, early on you mentioned the polo grounds and your memories of going to baseball games as a child. How do you feel about the 21st century ballpark?
It's a better place to watch a ball game than ever before. The multi-use stadium is on the way out. It is a dinosaur. And ballparks that are built in the last 20 years have been smaller in the playing dimensions than their predecessors, but also smaller in their seating capacity. So that a ballpark that can hold 45,000 people rather than 65,000 people seems more intimate. The idea of everything old being new again, you know, going back to the past for the model of what a baseball park should be, was a wise decision. It's a trend. It will reach its natural conclusion, and we'll find something different. If you love intimacy at the ballpark, then you love minor league baseball. And all the great things about minor league baseball that have been transported to the modern-day major league experience, that if you're going to a game, it's not merely to watch the game as you would at home. It's not merely to get a scorecard. It's a whole body experience.
Are you excited about the upcoming changes to Wrigley Field?
Neither excited nor saddened. Progress is inevitable. Specialization is inevitable. And the need to compete for dollars on the part of every franchise, even those two that have particularly venerable parks, Boston and Chicago, is inescapable. We cannot preserve ballparks as museums. And as one who went to Wrigley Field for the first time in 1963 and recalls going to Fenway in the 1970s, the millions of dollars spent on modernization at each of those parks over those years has been all to the good.
Last question for you, John. Years from now, how will future historians remember and describe this current era of baseball?
I hope they will describe it in the same way that I do, which is that there's a false nostalgia for baseball of 50 years ago or 100 years ago, and we imagine in baseball, unlike in any other sport, that somehow gods walked the earth. Heroes of old were taller, stronger, faster, higher character, higher moral bearing than the players of today. The game of baseball is better in each generation than in the preceding one. So while there is an interest in what happened and why, any historian at any time will have that same perspective, it is important not to confuse history with a false nostalgia. The good old days, they were not that great. Baseball has never been as good on the field as it is today. And one does not need to deny the attractions of the present while supporting the interest in the past.
Quickly, then, I must ask, who are some of your favorite baseball players to watch today?
I like McCutchen. McCutchen's fun to watch. Trout is also fun to watch, although his now celebrated weakness for pitches up in the strike zone is not reflected in his statistics line, and any young player would swap stat lines with him. I like the power pitchers. The emphasis on strikeouts lately has made Aroldis Chapman fascinating to watch, but it is a distraction because the purpose of a pitcher is not to strike out the batter, but to retire him. And the purpose of a baseball game is not to watch a duel between a pitcher and a batter, but to engage as many of the players as possible and keep the ball in the field of play. So we are at the end of, a dangerous trend, which is to see the game dominated by strikeouts, walks, and home run. I don't know if we need larger fields, if we need deader baseballs, if we need a deepened pitching distance. Something is going to have to change.
And you mentioned power pitchers. Who would you take, Clayton Kershaw or Sandy Koufax?
Both Kershaw and Koufax are power pitchers, but that is not what distinguishes them from their peers. It is artistry, and it is their breaking pitches. I mean, Kershaw's curveball is fantastic. Koufax's curveball is fantastic. Kershaw is as close over the last 5-6 years to Koufax at his peak, his 5-6 years as anyone that we have seen. And they're both a great pleasure to watch, not for their domination, their utter domination of batters, as for their durability, their consistency, and the remarkable run prevention year to year. The ERAs that we have seen from Kershaw are even more impressive than we saw with those at Koufax.
John Thorne, Major League Baseball historian, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today.